Welcome to the UFO File Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
Welcome back to our Roswell series. We're at the Cover Up Cafe, and this is the talk of the town, no doubt about it, and the talk of the nation, talk of the world, really. Don Smith and Tom Carey are here. Just before we came home, we did a little bit about your book. And we even had a little voice bit with Walter Hout talking about what he saw. You both have really done some great research here. Welcome to the show, by the way.
Well, thanks for having us both, Jerry.
And we plugged the book, and Amazon's already sold out, but they got a new order already.
I think that's pretty well going.
Yeah.
And we heard as of last night that there's a 2,000 back order on Amazon. So it just continues to prove that whenever the naysayers, whenever the skeptics say that, not only Roswell, but UFOs in general are passé, that whenever a legitimate, good
science story comes along,
a good investigative journalistic effort comes out, the people are still clamoring for the truth. And clearly regarding Roswell, they don't accept the three official explanations of what happened, and they still question, what if the first one? That Walter Hott, certainly now with a sealed statement, endorses that it was indeed the capture of a flying saucer.
Now when we talk about that, there are a lot of things came up in this. You guys did a lot of things with the debris field out at the ranch, but there seems to be other locations. Tom, can you tell me about that?
Our research, Jerry, has determined that we believe that there are three sites involved in the Roswell crash. The original debris field, which most everybody knows, the Air Force admits something crashed there. It's just a disagreement as to what crashed.
Well, and the affidavit in your book, that was on purpose, evidently. The Air Force wanted people to look at that debris field.
Yes. To get back to your original question, the second site is what we call the body site, where we believe when
we're in a restaurant, and
yes,
it was
like
a good timing. The busboy's working for us.
The craft exploded over Corona.
Now, you might tell everyone where Corona is exactly from here.
Corona is in north central New Mexico, about 75 to 85 miles northwest of Roswell. It's in the high desert, cattle town, old west type town. And Mac Roswell was the foreman of a cattle ranch there. The owner lived in Texas. And the site on the Foster, there's two sites on the Foster Ranch, the Foster Roswell Ranch, the original one, and then the body site where we think several bodies were blown out when the crash occurred.
Yeah.
And the third site is where was left, what we believe was an escape capsule of some sort, egg-shaped, finally crashed about 40 miles north of Roswell. So those are the three sites.
Now, is that called the Cobb Ranch or something? Where is this exactly? Escape pods, what I call it. I don't know what it was for sure.
I think we believe it was.
Yeah. No, that would not have been the terminology back at that time. But
we had to wait to Star Trek. The crew understood what an escape pod was.
The crew cabin, as far as...
Could have been the crew cabin that would survive. But it was egg-shaped, seamless. They called it a spacecraft back then. They didn't know about an escape pod. They just called it a spacecraft. And there were bodies associated with that site, too. So there's two body sites. The final impact site, and then a site 2.5 miles from the debris field. When the thing exploded, several fell out or were blown out.
And we're going to get into what could have happened there, but let's talk about the body situation right up front. That's probably getting the attention of listeners, especially ones not used to the Roswell story at all. How many bodies altogether do you figure? Five or three or one? The two different locations, right?
Yes. I'm leaning towards, and this is not exact by any means. Don may have a different view, but I'm leaning towards that there were four at the impact site, with one being alive, three dead, one alive, and then three at the body site on the Foster Ranch, all dead. So that would be a total of seven. I think Don might have a...
We could accept a minimum of six based on the eyewitness testimony. Even for the descriptions at the Brazel Ranch, just the use of the word they, I mean, plural, suggesting that there was two minimum.
Didn't he say there was, or somebody said there was two, and the bodies were a couple miles from the debris field? Or?
Which is interesting in that it is one of the things, and as much as we would disagree with the authenticity of the MJ-12 documents, but as any good disinformation agenda, it has to have a smattering of truth to it. And that indeed may be one of the elements within the documents which refers to the bodies being discovered in those documents 2.5 miles from the debris field.
The government's pretty sly, and MJ-12 may or may not be the government, part of a black group that's running everything. They're pretty sly in using a little bit of the truth in misdirection.
Well, it has to draw you in.
And it's just
outright fabrication.
In the hot affidavit, and we might go into exactly how that came about. He did one back in the 90s, too, right? Didn't he do some sort of an affidavit or a statement or something? No, he didn't.
No.
Just this one. And it was released after his death?
Though, Jerry, you are correct that there was an original affidavit prepared as there was a conference in Washington, D.C. in 1991, May of 1991. Mm-hmm. And Walter was one of about a dozen witnesses that were brought into Washington. There was discussion at that time of an attempt to enlist the late Congressman Stephen Schiff of New Mexico in just representing his own constituents back here in New Mexico, and then a potential push for congressional hearings on the incident. And affidavits were prepared for each witness based on their testimony at that time. And as we all know, up until the sealed statement, all Walter would acknowledge was that he took the order from Colonel William Blanchard, the base commander, to type up the press release as it was dictated to him and then distribute it to the two local newspapers and the two local radio stations. And that in itself serves as, you know, a pretext as to the importance of why Walter waited all those years and basically took the truth to his grave in many respects. And in that, the opportunity of preparing a sealed statement for posthumous release was the one thing that he finally did agree to.
Had he agreed to that well in advance, or was that something kind of a last-minute decision on his part? He passed away, what, in 2001 or 2?
No, 2005.
Five, okay.
Right. And this was something that, as we had even broached any type of sworn statement, whether posthumous or living, it all came down to what Walter had slowly through the years admitted. He was rather cryptic at times, but it all became a compilation of things that he had told us.
Right.
And a few others through the years. And then this was in 2002. So this was fully 3 years before he passed away.
And did you know this thing existed?
Yes. We knew that it existed. We knew its content.
But you were agreeing not to do anything about it. Until,
precisely.
Right.
We had agreed, as Walter himself had requested, that it would be strictly for posthumous release and also by as a decision by the family as to its pedigree.
Yeah, Don Schmidt and Tom Carey are here, and we're talking about the book, and we're going to give it another big plug here when we go to the break. But I want to ask you something, Tom. He mentioned you guys knew Walter really well. You've been coming to the UFO Museum for how many years?
Forever. I was in Stanton Friedman and I were honorary pallbearers.
Yeah, and I was lucky enough to meet him one time, and he talked around these things, but I imagine with you guys, he knew you pretty well, so he probably was fairly direct, or was he not?
Well, I can give you my impression.
Yeah, right.
Very honorable man, decent. If you had a club or organization, he would be the one you would elect president.
Yeah, he was a likable fellow.
Yes. I know. I tried to get him to talk over the years, and
yeah, that's what my whole point of this question is.
It wasn't that I grabbed him by
the throat. Oh no, no, no.
Talk. It was you try to pick your time, and he just would not come forward with any. The closest he got to anything was saying that I think it was. I believe it was a UFO.
Yeah.
Just don't ask me why.
Yeah.
And that gets you thinking. Well, if he only did the press release, and that's all he knows, how can he make the statement that he believes this is a UFO? The other thing was, he was William Blanchard's right-hand man. They were very close. He could have followed Blanchard all the way up to the Pentagon.
Now this is the commander of the base.
Commander of the base.
The wing.
And, you have to believe that when this was going down in 1947, wasn't he the least bit curious as to what was going on? That's what you would have to believe of him, that he was not curious. They never asked Blanchard. We did not accept that. And
why do you think, either one of you can answer this question, why do you think he wanted to wait till after his death to say what he said? Did he make a promise to Blanchard?
We knew already.
Yeah.
We knew already. Yeah, it was a promise to Butch.
Uh-huh. That's what he called him.
The old man, as he would call him. Right.
Butch asked him never to reveal this, and that was good enough for Walter. This was America's greatest generation. Your word was bond.
Yeah.
He promised Butch, and that's all it was. And this was his way.
I wonder how Blanchard felt about him opening up the UFO Museum.
Well, as we described even in the book, that we've learned through members of the Blanchard family and even Barry Goldwater in his one last letter that Blanchard had even told him all about Roswell in the mid-60s. So one can only imagine.
Told Goldwater.
So one can only imagine that Blanchard himself lived with that same burden of possessing the information, possessing the truth of one of the biggest stories, certainly the biggest story of the millennium. And we mentioned in the book that I'm sure Walter would feel that he was doing just what Butch would want him to do, Colonel Blanchard, with the museum, that he at least was providing the public with a repository, with an historic preservation that not only dignified the 509th Atomic Bomb Squadron, based here in Roswell at that time, the men involved, and preserved the information, the testimony, afforded them, even indirectly, through the efforts of investigators and even family members who would come forward. And so many of these people who took it to their graves, at least they see that the truth always tends to come forward.
Now when we talk about the live ET, how do we know that? Did Hott see the live ET, or do you have another witness? Or
we have a number of witnesses who saw a live one. This would be at the impact site where that egg-shaped craft was, and there are a number of witnesses that they'll always say, I saw so many bodies, but one was alive. How long it remained alive is a question. There are stories that one remained until 1952 when expired, others that it died soon thereafter, coming to the base.
And even the new testimony of Eli Benjamin at the base hospital as they transported the bodies from P3, Hangar 84, over to the hospital, and one of the sheets falling from the gurney and observing the movement.
So it was moving.
Yes. And we have much secondhand testimony as well, whether regarding Senator Joseph Montoya saw movement, Miriam Bush, the space administrator's private secretary, Pappy Henderson. So
did the extraterrestrial that was still living was injured, obviously. Did it make painful noises or anything? Did anybody ever say that?
I don't know that one reported that it was moaning.
Well, Montoya's, the Anaya brothers,
that
right?
They could hear it moaning. And the other information conveyed is from one of the firemen that went out to the site before the military got there.
Yeah, this was found by civilians, right?
Yes, just as the original, the debris field.
Uh-huh.
Right.
But the fireman, Dan Dwyer, through his family, said that they asked him, well, did it say anything to you? And he said, yes. But in his head, that's how he described it. He talked to him in his head. And, well, what did it say? It said, well, don't worry. There's nothing you can do. I accept my fate that he would not be returning wherever he came from. So he was trying to reassure the firemen not to be upset at the sight of him, that he accepted what had happened.
And did you get any one at all, officially or unofficially, off the record or whatever, to say, well, after all these years, we know where they came from?
Whenever we're asked that question, we respond, you know, in like fashion, that we leave that to the astronomers.
Okay.
To us, it's the investigation, accumulating as much of the circumstantial eyewitness testimony as possible, racing with the mortician in tracking down the surviving, you know, witnesses to the event, and one can always speculate, but no, we don't even address that.
Speculation to a minimum. Our task is to find out what happened and why, and track down every last witness that's still.
Do you think you found most of them?
No.
Okay.
However, most of them are gone now.
Yeah.
There are still witnesses alive. I would say that 90% of the base, the military at the base, and you could include the civilians in Corona around Roswell, are gone now. And half of those that are left are suffering from the vagaries of life. You know?
We're going to take a break, and we'll get back and talk about your investigations and some of the other findings, too. This is just one of those things that sets you on the edge of your chair. But one thing I want to find out, if I had seen something from another world, I don't know how I would have been able to keep quiet, but a lot of people did. We'll be right back. This is Jerry Pepin. Our guests are Tom Carey and Don Schmidt. We're at the cover-up cafe right down the street from the UFO Museum. And I alluded to, you've been coming to Roswell and the UFO Museum for years. The museum is really had a lot of people from everywhere, millions, right?
Actually, over 2 million.
Yeah.
And for us, it is also
Every time I'm here, I meet somebody from Belgium or France or someplace, right out of the blue.
150 different countries. Mm-hmm. But what always brings us back to the museum, and one of the reasons we certainly stay involved with the museum, is that it has also served as a provider for new witnesses, new leads. We have had witnesses numerous times who just felt that they would make this pilgrimage. They would come back to Roswell, and in some cases they would even say to see if we got it right.
Mm-hmm.
And others just to see if it was coming out, to see how much, if one of their old Army buddies had actually come forward as they had been, you know, rumored to say.
It's interesting. That was going to be my next question. Any military people come forward, or mostly civilian witnesses from you guys' investigation? I'm not asking you to give
a military involved.
Yeah.
So the numbers would be skewed in that direction. And we have the base yearbook from 1947, which is like our source document for trying to track these people. So most of them were military. And you would ask, I think, how they could keep this.
Yeah, right.
Certainly Don couldn't do it today. He would be right out there. But back in 1947, you're talking about America's greatest generation. And it's right after World War II, the Cold War is starting, and your commanding officer says, you will never say a word about this for the rest of your life. And just to reinforce that, we're going to send Arthur Philbin over here, Lieutenant Arthur Philbin, and he's going to talk to you. And Arthur Philbin comes out, he gets
baton, and he's, yeah.
He says, you say anything, you're a dead man. Well, that makes an impression on you. And career officers, if you're a career officer, you don't go to your commanding officer and say, hey, how about that Roswell case? That's not going to enhance your career.
Mm-hmm.
So the military was easy to keep the secret. Civilians, it was a little more difficult because there was no direct authority.
You're talking about difficult to keep it quiet.
You can't. They used issue a mandate or an order to civilians without putting some physical threat behind it. And so in the same token, we had military officials going to civilian homes, issuing the same type of threats to parents and children. The sheriff was dispatched and sent from house to house as far as to emphasize those warnings, right? They used the sheriff's department. So rather extreme measures for the recovery of any conventional device. And we're talking about an area
Why do you think it is so extreme? How can they keep it 60 years? Why is it still secret?
Jerry, we get that every interview, we get that question. And the answer is always the same. Back in 1947, valid reasons. But what happens is, as the longer you keep a secret, it gets a life of its own.
Self-perpetuating,
and at some point, if you admit the lie, well, then you're telling everybody, hey, we're liars.
Mm-hmm.
We lied to you. Somebody's going to pay a price for that. And you know, politicians, their main task is getting reelected. That's what they do. And someone will pay a price if they admit the lie.
So do you think we'll ever have official disclosure?
I would say that as long as there are any surviving witnesses as well as family, because the other thing that would certainly also be disclosed were the threats that we just talked about a few moments ago, and the accountability, the fact that our own United States government resorted to physical threats to its own people.
Yeah, basically that's against the law.
Precisely, precisely, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we understand that, but
Mac Brazel, the rancher himself, when he was not even provided due process, when he was apprehended and then detained at the base for a week, was not even.
He was there a whole week, huh?
I knew he was delayed, but
I didn't realize it was a whole week.
And not even allowed to call his own wife to inform her where he was.
Sheriff Wilcox, the Roswell incident destroyed him. Never ran for office again. It absolutely destroyed him.
And that's how the family put it. He was destroyed.
And the reason they sent Philbin over to threaten Dan Dwyer, the fireman, and not Wilcox, is because he was Wilcox's friend, and Wilcox wouldn't do it to a friend. So they sent Philbin over.
Most of these people, as we mentioned at the top of the show, the mortuary is getting them, the funeral home is getting them. Someday,
there won't be any more.
And maybe the black vault will open.
But as we originally were optimistic of that possibility.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't detect this optimism anymore.
Well, originally,
yeah.
With the growing faction we were hearing about within the military, that They wanted full disclosure. They did. Their desire is that it does come out. But then, as evidence with explanation number 3 with Project Mogul, and then with number 4 with the anthropomorphic wooden crash dummies, it's quite clear to us that they're trying to clamp the lid down even tighter.
Yeah, there seems to be spurts,
and
ups and downs.
One witness said the game plan is to run out the clock.
Run out the timetable, right.
Run out the clock.
Well,
so at some point there won't be any.
The final witnesses pass on, and it's cover-up complete.
Talking about threats, as you guys go around asking questions, anybody threaten you?
Not that I know of, but maybe Don, but not me.
I keep getting audited, so I don't know that.
Yeah. Oh, that's just a coincidence. But anyway.
Three times.
Yeah, right.
But, yeah, we just had clicks last night again. So I think years before, there was a witness that Kevin Randall was speaking to, and about 5 minutes into the conversation, they could hear all the earlier comments being played back to them.
Right.
So it wasn't an echo. And neither one was recording, so it was very blatant, as though, we're listening, just to let you know.
Yeah.
And
It seems intimidation is what the government likes to use anyway.
And just to, again, remind us at times that there's a watchful eye. We have to also remember that there is absolutely no way that we believe that there's any one person in the government or in the military that knows the whole story, that is aware of every witness, that has the reins on all these people after 60 years. So in many ways, we're doing their job. Every time we come out with a new piece of information, it's almost like they're reacting, damn, how did we miss that one?
I've always suspected that in many of these investigations, people in the media and investigative journalists turn up more than the government do, and they start visiting with you to find out what
but
you really know.
That's the advantage we have.
Yeah.
In that we're able to step out from the big picture, and we're not part of the loop, so as a result we can keep approaching it from different directions, and that's one of the reasons that we don't have obviously the unlimited manpower, we don't have the unlimited resources, but we have just the wealth of eyewitness testimony that piecemeal they might be able to put all together, but collectively we have it.
Let's go back to this affidavit a little bit. Haught was actually able to go pick up something in the debris field and take it to his office, evidently, huh?
Yes. What's interesting here, Jerry, is that unknown to Walter Haught, at the time that he crafted the sealed statement, we had interviewed a fellow who had worked for him in the public information office, a private Lloyd Nelson, worked for Walter. He basically told the same story. He said that one day Walter and Jesse Marcel Sr. came into the office, each carrying pieces of this debris, and one of them was one of these I-beams that had a funny writing on it. And so he concluded that Walter and Jesse Marcel had just come back from one of the crash sites. And they were showing this around to the office, and they had a piece of the memory metal, and, hey, guys, look at this. And everybody handled it. And when they turned around to leave, Walter said, oh, by the way, nobody say anything about this. We didn't see it. and Walter did not know about that. Lloyd Nelson, in his conversation to us, said, a few years before Walter died, he called him, knowing that Walter knew about this, just to find out what Walter knew, and he said, even with me, he wouldn't tell me.
Yeah.
He still kept it, except for me.
One of the other things was evidently General Ramey made it over to Roswell that morning, huh? When did this crash happen? Was it on the 3rd or the 4th, 11:45 at night, or what time?
Well, not being precise on the time, but we believe that it was July 3rd.
July 3rd.
Just before the 4th of July weekend. There were witnesses to the effect that they were returning home for the holiday weekend, and they heard things, they saw things, and all essentially determined that it was the 3rd.
One fellow who, his wife said, when he worked the next day, he didn't drink at night. Well, this night he was drunk.
One of the military,
he didn't work the next day.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Which had to be July the
Okay.
And she heard the crash, the explosion.
Mm-hmm.
And she heard it that night that he was drunk, so it had to be at least putting two and two together.
Do you think it was a collision, a shoot down, radar? What do you think caused it? Nobody knows?
Speculation, yeah. There is no eyewitness testimony. There is nothing that we have ever come across to suggest that there was a collision, that there were more than two objects involved, that there was a shoot down. In fact, there were no fighters stationed here in Roswell at that time. There was a tremendous lightning storm, thunderstorm that night. Anyone familiar with the central part of New Mexico?
Yeah, we had a few last couple of days.
They are extremely vivid, very loud, torrential, and that being the monsoon season of July and August of each summer. And it could simply be nothing more than a malfunction within the craft itself, and have no reason to believe otherwise.
We get the question all the time, well, if you had a ship that came from another galaxy to here, how could it explode? Well, we don't know.
But it did.
Right.
And then they also would ask, well, what about the this material that was nearly indestructible? How is it that it broke up the way it did? And we respond by just reminding people that, well, based on our technology, we couldn't cut it. We couldn't break it. We couldn't figure it out. But everything that is manufactured has to be malleable at a certain level. And it's just that their stress point is much higher than ours.
Good point. We'll be right back. Tom Carey and Don Smith are our guests. We're at the Cover Up Cafe. We're in Roswell, right down the street from the UFO Museum. And we got another segment or two with them, and then we're going to introduce you to our crew here. We got a whole, well, we're going to do 25 hours before we get out of here on Sunday night. So you guys do marathons, too, when you do the investigations and all that.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, and this is one right now. We'll be right back. I'm Jerry Pippin.
The year was 1970 when Jack Blanchard and Misty Morgan released their first big single hit, Tennessee Birdwalk. For the first time in the history of music, this 45 RPM single becomes available to the public in the form of a mouse pad. Made of high-quality quarter-inch rubber, this fabric-covered 8-inch mouse pad delivers your mouse a very smooth ride. For only $9.95 plus $2.50 shipping and handling, your mouse pad will be rushed via USPS first-class mail. Simply click on the happy little mice and be directed to our ordering page. Hurry while this limited time offer lasts.
It's Tennessee Birdwalk.